When we talk about the English League, there are two very different eras, the amateur and the professional. The former was dominated by one club, Bath. 10 domestic cups and 6 league titles for 14 years in the late 80s and early 90s, the West Country Giants stood above all and sundry. But as the amateur years were left behind, so too were the halcyon days of one of the world's oldest rugby clubs. In the latest episode of our Rugby Stories podcast series, we head back to one glorious season when Bath became the first British side to lift the Heineken Cup.
The history and the heritage was something I was acutely aware of. I wanted to be part of that production line that delivers so much success.
How about that?
It was a brutal school, and that's what set Bath apart.
Pick you a number out, run it in, and fight.
Dan Lyle picks and drives!
And there was just so many leaders, there were so many outstanding players.
A charging Abogu!
Bath don't go to finals to lose.
Just the be-all and end-all for Bath to win the Heineken Cup.
Nicol, thunderous.
They were powerful and they were nasty.
Callum, he's over!
So much experience, so much big-time match mentality.
The clock's against you. We've got no comeback.
My face, I'm like a ghost.
Seconds to go. It's come down to this.
Yeah, everything you dream for.
In Rugby Stories, you'll get the full, extended, uncut anecdotes from the players, coaches and key figures. Some never told before. Bath were the all-conquering giants of amateur rugby, the heroes of the recreation ground. But remember, as it was an amateur game back then, all their stars still had jobs outside of rugby. The professional era changed everything. Bath captain Andy Nicol was used to playing in front of 65,000 screaming fans at Murrayfield for Scotland and then going back to his job working for a printing firm in Bristol.
I moved down in 94. I was finishing my university degree in Dundee and I wanted to play in England. It was before agents. It was obviously the game was still very much amateur at the time. I sort of made it known to a few friends that I wanted to try England, and so the jungle drums started beating and Gloucester came in for me, and I was speaking to Barry Corliss, who was the director of rugby at the time, probably before it was even called director of rugby. He said, look, we'd love you to join us, and I said, look, give me a few days, I'd like to speak to my family and friends, which I did, and then I said I'll call him back on the Sunday. So I had those conversations, decided I was going to Gloucester, and then genuinely at 6 o'clock on that Sunday night, Brian Ashton phoned from Bath, and I said yes immediately. Bath were, you know, the most dominant in the amateur era. They'd won everything, and I'd watched it on Rugby Special. I remember seeing the wreck and just absolutely teeming with people, it seemed, every time, and the rugby was fantastic. It was right in the heart of the city, and you know, because of that dominance, because of the players they had, I jumped at the chance, and it was a great opportunity, and I loved it. You know, I come from Dundee, which is very much a football city. When Dundee High Rugby Club were playing, which was my team, nobody in Dundee knew that was on. There was no colours, there was no one wearing strips or anything. But when Bath are playing at home, just the whole city is blue, black and white. I lived in a square, St James's Square. You know, there was a newsagent, a laundrette, a deli, and if you went in there after winning on the Saturday, you know, you got a free cake, or you got your laundry done for free. And likewise, if you lost, which didn't happen very often, you know, there was questions asked why. It took over the whole city, and I loved that.
Oh, it's back to Stuart Barnes. It's a long way out. It'll be close. It is over. And the arch storyteller has written another.
We've seen teams dominate the English club game over the years. Leicester did it, Wasps did it, Saracens have obviously done it recently, but not to the scale that Bath did in that amateur era.
Bath are champions.
But it was huge dominance. The John Player Cup final, or the Pilkington Cup final, was an annual pilgrimage that the Bath fans bought tickets at the start of the year because they knew, pretty damn sure, that Bath were going to be there in the final.
Fullback John Callard spent his whole career at Bath from 1989 to 1999, teaching PE and biology at Downside School in Somerset before turning professional. He'd go on to coach at Bath and England. Under Jack Ryle's leadership in the amateur game, Callard felt he was joining a winning machine.
It was double winning, it was league winning, it was cup winning, there was internationals galore there. And people just wanted that experience. They thought, well, that's it. We'll buy a player in and we can build a club around it.
It's a great story of just great players, a sort of golden generation coming together at Bath at the same time.
I think we were probably more professional in the amateur era than we were in the professional era, if that makes sense. The timings of it, that boys would train twice a week, three times a week at the club, but also on their own, they would do three or four sessions. And you'd be found out if you didn't do those sessions. It was a tough school. It was brutal. And I don't use the word about being bullied or pushed. It was a brutal school, and that's what set Bath apart. It was dog eat dog. I mean, there was a lot of respect at the club for each other and what they achieved, but if you didn't perform or pull your finger out for the club, you were told. You were known in no uncertain terms what it meant. The closest thing I could put it to, and this is a testament to the club, it's like an all-black shirt. You're given it, you respect it, you try and make it better, and then you pass it on.
Jack Ryle left Bath to take the England job in 1995. A measure of his legacy was the conveyor belt of future England coaches who'd passed through the recreation ground in the 1990s. Brian Ashton replaced Ryle to lead the team into the professional era before Matt's teacher, Andy Robinson, who played 249 games for the club, became head coach. One of the key members of Robinson's Bath team in 1998 was former British and Irish Lion and dual code Welsh international Richard Webster.
I met Jeremy Guscott in 93 with the Lions, and I think he was a little bit of an instigator in getting me to the club. We got on very well together, which was a bit unusual, you know. I was playing in Salford for four seasons up in rugby league, and come 96 then, and we were all allowed back pretty much to professional rugby. And everybody around me was going back to clubs in Wales and clubs in England, and I was being pretty much left on the shelf. But then I was lucky enough to have... I was going to play. I'd signed a dual contract with Oro, 50% obviously with Salford and with Oro, but then I was lucky enough that Bath came in for me, which was a great opportunity, and I took it with both hands. I did go back to Oro to tell them what was going on, and I will be honest, they came in where they were going to give me another offer, but I didn't take it because I pretty much just wanted to go and play for Bath. I went to the first game in a blazer and a tie like I should normally, and they all turned up in flip-flops and ripped T-shirts. You know, they were the pop stars, you know. They were like the boy band of the rugby world, you know. They were confident. They'd come from a very successful amateur career I'd watched and I admired, but then as we come into the professional era, it didn't quite play off quite as much. Brian Ashton was the head coach, and he had this idea of complete rugby, and he wanted to have the ball in play. He used to time us on how long we kept the ball in play. You know, he didn't want it kicked off. He didn't want dead play. He wanted the ball to be played, you know, in the hands as much as possible. So they were trying to play a brand of rugby, and they were wanting to be the best team, but there wasn't a marker. You know, but then coming into the professional era, when they became a marker with Europe, but unfortunately we were off the mark for the first year.
As the game changed, so did the landscape of rugby, and Bath's dominance began to diminish.
I think we struggled immensely because I think everybody wanted a piece of Bath. They wanted a bit of that knowledge, that experience that Bath created, built, and, you know, the likes of Rowell, Hudson, the late Dave Robson, those sort of guys that helped build that club. And people wanted a piece of it, you know. Ben Clark, I think, went to Richmond for sums. I can only speak from my experience where I was asked to go to Worcester with, sadly, the late Cecil Duckworth, who a lovely man, you know, second or third, even maybe fourth division, to be a player coach there. And they wanted that experience that I had to take from Bath to build that culture. That's what it was. And really, we were being pulled from all sides because all of a sudden, the game was professional, it was now your job. It was tough.
I think John's been very kind. I think it was appalling, I'll be honest. But we weren't alone. You know, I think when the game went professional, nobody really knew what to do. Nobody really knew how to prepare a rugby team in the professional environment. The only team that did it well was Newcastle, because they were aligned under Sir John Hall at the time to Newcastle United. So they knew sports science, the recovery, nutrition, all that, because obviously Newcastle United football had done it for years and years and years. The rest of the rugby teams, we were just making it up. There was almost a blank sheet of paper. We went from training twice a week and playing on a Saturday to training twice a day and playing on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, depending when the TV game dictated it. It was like they filled each day with training, and there was no real structure, science to it. It was probably the science that was available at the time, but when you look back now, or not even 5 years into professional rugby, you look back and think, wow, we got that so wrong. And I think, I don't know who it was that said this, but I'll take credit for it if I can't remember who it was, that Bath were the most professional of amateur sides, yet the most amateur of professional sides.
I played for Salford for four seasons, and in four seasons we never tackled each other once in training. So we never done one physical contact session in training. But when we went into the game, you know, in rugby league, it's an unwritten rule. It's 13 of you and 13 of you hard, and 13 of you stand up and be counted. You know, I've seen small backs, outside halves, playing with broken arms, you know, until they get dragged off. That's the unwritten rule. But we never had to do it in training. It was always done on the field. I went to Bath. Why I don't think they grasped the professional era quite so much was we trained 5 days a week, and every week we beat each other up in training. When we come to the weekend, we weren't quite as sharp as we should have been, but I think it was the case of we are paying you lots of money, you do as we say, which didn't really work out then when it came to putting it out on the field on a Saturday.
We didn't make that transition very well at all. But I'm not, as I say, we weren't alone in that. It just, I guess, because of the success that Bath had had in the amateur era, everyone just presumed that that success would continue. The mistakes that were made meant that we probably came back into the pack a little bit.
We had changes of coaches, and then Andy Robinson retired and came in as the head coach. He fetched Clive Woodward in. There were a lot of youngsters coming through at that time. You know, I think Bath had one of the best academy systems at the time, and I'd see fantastic players coming up and coming through 1 year, and you go away for a couple of weeks, come back and start pre-season, and then youngsters would be gone. But when you looked at the players that they kept, like your Balshaws, Matt Perrys, Gareth Cooper, Steve Borthwick, all internationals, a lot of them went on to be Lions, and a lot of them went on to be great. So Andy Robinson and the other coaches were very clever at keeping the ones that were important and that were going to play, you know, the Bath way.
Robinson kept a nucleus of talented youth players and began to reshape Bath, as Andy Nicol remembers.
I mean, Andy Robinson was probably the most competitive man on this planet. I played with him as a player. He then became player coach. And so I had a good relationship with Andy, a really good working relationship with Andy, because we played, obviously, back row, scrum half. When we were players, we interacted a lot together. When he made me captain, we worked very well together. So I always say that the role of the captain is to implement the coach's views and opinions and strategy and tactics on the pitch. And so you have to have that relationship between captain and coach. We had an honest relationship. We had a few issues, but you want that. You want discourse. You want debate. You know, as I said, there was a few issues at the club that we happened to deal with, and I was privy to some difficult conversations. But we always had a very good relationship. And we saw the game in the same way. I think that's really important. Not that we had to mirror everything that one said to the other, but how the game was played, how Bath wanted to play it, how to get the best from it, we were aligned. And I think that was really important.
You know, as far as I was concerned, I think the club was still trying to get a foothold in professional rugby and trying to develop or fetch their game from the amateur era and fetch everybody into being a little bit more professional and competing a little bit better within the Premiership.
Having finished as runners-up the year before, Bath hosted Newcastle in their opening home game of the 1997-98 season in the newly formed Allied Dunbar Premiership with plenty of optimism. But the Premiership new boys were to give the established elite a rude awakening.
The whole season, 97-98, was still trying to set ourselves up to fit in with professional rugby.
There's a real feeling around this place, around the wreck, a belief that this might be a special season for Bath. A new season underway. This is Stimpson. Dean Ryan not taking long to get in the mood. Inga Twigamala, the opening try. Options wide, Twigamala to leg, and an opening day win for Newcastle.
That was an incredibly topsy-turvy season for Bath. Domestically, we were very poor. We had a number of issues off the field. There was a few discipline issues that were quite off-putting. We also had some terrible defeats. It wasn't a great season, quite the opposite. You know, through that dominance in the amateur era, Bath had always rated themselves as the best team in Europe, but they had no vehicle to actually back that up. And so when the Heineken Cup came along, it absolutely became the Holy Grail.
The shock home defeat to eventual champions Newcastle seemed to set the tone for a domestic season of inconsistency for Bath. When it came to Europe, though, something special was starting to happen. Bath were in the same pool as cup holders Brive, a talented but scrappy Pontypridd, and Scottish Borders. Bath opened Pool 3 with a cross-border derby and won our bruising trip to South Wales.
We had Pontypridd and we had difficulties against Pontypridd. I can remember Andy Robinson asking me to stand up in the hotel the morning before we played Pontypridd just to explain to the players what it was going to be like. I mean, you know, you play an English club and you might have one person who's passionate and a little bit angry around the edges, and I was trying to explain to them, look, you're going to have 15 people were a bit passionate and very angry around the edges. Plus, that's going to be backed up with perhaps 20,000 people from Pontypridd that are a little bit angry and and very passionate.
More problems. Phil de Glanville has left the field with blood.
You're going to go into like a cold run that's you're never going to be experienced before. You know, playing against Pontypridd, against the chief, all his followers, everybody that goes with it. And I think we come out of there and they realised actually what it was like playing at Sardis Road. It's not nice. So when we went into the 98 season, we had them. You know, we had that in our backup so that we knew what to expect and we knew what we were going to come up against.
That little kick through might be too far, but the try has been awarded. Richard Butland.
A hard-fought 21-15 win over Pontypridd was followed by a win in Scotland, but the big test in Pool 3 was to follow in Game 3 at the Rec. Brieve, the European champions. They had thrashed Leicester 28-9 in the previous season's cup final. Brieve had also won their opening two games in the pool, although the week before had been a one-point win over Pontypridd in a match known as the Battle of Brieve. The post-match brawl in a French bar would see three Brieve internationals hospitalised and three Pontypridd players in court.
We were lucky enough to play Brieve the week after they played Pontypridd in the Battle of Brieve. It was a battle on the field and, as everybody knows, it was an even bigger battle off the field. I think a few of the players got more injured off the field in the bar later on, which ultimately helped Bath, because the week after the Brieve team turned up at Bath, still under massive media speculation of what went on and who was to blame and what was the outcome, and they stepped off the team bus and they looked like they were getting off the St John's ambulance, because there was more bandages around their faces. Most of the top players were all wrapped up in, I think Penno had a big strap around his nose and watched the game. It was a little bit ridiculous. I think it was like more of a media stunt than there was anything wrong with them, but it played into our hands because they had 30% of their side not playing, and we beat them at home on the day. So I don't know, it was just the French being a little bit emotional and just trying to, we didn't know what they were trying to get out of it. You know, they played the week later, but it was a massive media thing, because it was in the papers all through the week, it was in the media all through the week, it was all over the TV, and I think they were just trying to show up just to say, this is what Pontypridd done to us, this is what Pontypridd are.
We knew when you looked at the fixtures that Brieve loomed large in that group, you know, so the defending champions, they destroyed Leicester at Cardiff in the final of the year before.
The extra incentive for Bath was to be the first British side to become European champions. They had Brieve to thank for keeping that record intact going into the 97-98 season.
At club level, the rivalry is great. And so our rivalry with Leicester, it was proper. There wasn't much love lost. There was no friendship there. There was a lot of England boys obviously played together. It seemed that the Bath boys who were in the England squads were more friends with the Wasp guys or the Harlequins. With Leicester, there was a real issue. And so when they got to the final, yeah, I'll be honest, I'll be happy to admit that we didn't want Leicester to win that, because we wanted to be the first English club or the first British club to lift the Heineken Cup. And so... And that's not being disrespectful, that's just rivalry. And I think that's what drove us on.
People don't realise the part that the crowd play at Bath. You know, when they're unhappy, they let you know they're unhappy. But when you're entertaining them and you're giving them something to shout about, they're 16th, 17th, 18th men at times. And I do genuinely mean that. They're fantastic fans, fantastic supporters. And it was one of those days where we were producing a game. It was a game of ding-dong going back and forth, Brieve were playing rugby.
Oh, that's a special try. Cornet, Penno, and this is Carratt, and that's another.
Matt Perry scored a try, good try.
Now Matt Perry, in.
And it was tight, it was nip and go right to the end.
Oh, that's speedy from Mike Catt, how about that?
Arbizu could have won the game in injury time.
Sandro Arbizu to win it. No. And there it is. A trip to Brieve to come, but a very decent start.
You know, as players, you think, wow, we've been in a ding-dong there, but... You don't look back and say we're fortunate. You just look back and say, let's ride our fortune.
A kick to win it, missed by Brieve. Bath were 27-25 winners. But Brieve will get the chance for revenge on the return trip to France 2 weeks later. And it's fair to say the Bath players were a bit overwhelmed by the occasion, as John Callard remembers.
Our preparations were slightly surreal. It's the first time that Bath had a chartered plane out of Bristol. Only did they realise it was a Dakota, whatever it was, from 1950, propeller jobby that took longer than actually driving to get there. And it was a beautiful, beautiful aircraft. But I can always remember the boys just thinking, what's this all about? What's this all about? And then if you're not used to traveling abroad to teams, places like that, and their culture, you know, the food's slightly different, and just the heat and the sort of casualness around the game, you can get lost that you're playing in a game of rugby.
My abiding memory of the away game was that there was a number of players, including myself, had a few injuries, and we were coming back from injury, but we hadn't had much game time. And we knew how important that game was going to be, not to win that to have to qualify, but just we knew that Brive were going to be going deep in the tournament and we wanted to do the same.
It's on here, you know, hoisted over the top to Pascal Bomarty.
Both games probably could have gone either way, to be perfectly honest. And that just confirmed we knew that Brive were a good side. That was almost just a bit of positioning. I think by that stage we knew that we were both going to go through. And so it was a case of, right, let's get through them. We'll come and see you again, hopefully, in a bigger stage.
Bath and Brive would meet again, of course. For now, it was about sealing top spot in the group and a home quarter-final. Bath beat Pontypridd at the Rec to secure that home date against old rivals Cardiff. And to add even more spice to the game, Cardiff had dumped Bath out of Europe the season before, at the exact same stage.
There's so much history between Cardiff and Bath. This is what created Bath, the rugby club, is going over the Severn Bridge every Wednesday, Saturday, to play like the likes of Cardiff, Clonakilty, Newport, Pontypool back then. And you speak to anyone at the club who's been around for years, that really was what gave them the hard edge, that they never lost, and that was still there as we came into the professional era. So Cardiff was a huge fixture. We'd played them the year before in the knockout stage, and bad memory for me, I was recovering from a hamstring injury, and you can kind of massage it through the week. I sort of hadn't gone full 100% on it, and first second put high ball up, had to sprint it, and it popped. It was a bad experience. It was over in Cardiff. It was Jason Robinson and Henry Paul had just joined the club from when they were on their secondment from Wigan Warriors. So it was they were integrated in. There was a lot of things going on behind the scenes that didn't quite work.
People don't really talk about the making of Bath through playing the Welsh. There was an expression somebody said that if you go up the A46 that's out of Bath and you turn left, if you're going to Wales, you're in for a game today. If you're turning right, you could probably have the afternoon off. And that was an expression that, you know, you went over there with the second team or the first team. And the early Welsh games against Bath were legendary. You know, there was one game at the Knoll, Jonathan Davis, Elgin Rees, Faneath. It was just the making of Bath, those defeats. You know, at that era, you learn from your defeats rather than dwell on them. Playing Cardiff, a good Cardiff side, previous years and the generations before us, had put us in good stead to handle a good side like that.
So then when it came to the quarter-final, which was at the Rec, it's one of my favourite club games. I just thought it was brilliant because I loved that history. I loved the heritage that went with it.
Richard Webster was geared up for a huge game against some of his good friends, but his coach had other ideas.
That game's not a great memory for me. I had, I think me and Robbo nearly come to blows over that. I played in every minute of every game, I think, up until the quarter-final. And then because we were playing Cardiff and I knew a few of the players, he said I would be a liability to play. So he dropped me completely out of the squad. I think I went to London with my wife that weekend and I stayed right away from it. Me and Robert weren't friends for a few weeks.
I love the values of rugby, that there's no segregation. But when you do get segregation, or it was unofficial segregation, 3,000 Cardiff fans were positioned in one part of the stand. It created a wonderful atmosphere. It was a real intense game. It was way better than the semi-final. I loved that quarter-final because there was so much history. You know, I love my history. I'm a sports geek in that regard. And so I knew how important this was. And so it was just brilliant to be a part of that in such a hugely important game, i.e. the quarter-final of the Heineken Cup.
Here we are again then, a rerun of last season's quarter-final, and Cardiff supporters have travelled across the bridge in numbers.
That game took a knock, twisted my ankle a little bit, and my role off a centre scrum was to defend the left-hand side. And fair play to Cardiff, they picked and they exploited that space. And I thought, this is a better side than what we think.
Here goes Andy Nicol. Oh, he's loving this.
Every part of that game was fantastic to be a part of.
And cult hero Victor Abugu would score a crucial try.
Oh, Caxow, the bounce, he's lost it. And this is Abugu trundling through. Oh, Victor.
Vic was just one of these characters. I love being in his company, whether that on the pitch or off the pitch, and I still do. Never underestimate his ability. A lot of his character, there was the sort of this pop, you know, champagne and all that. He was a great rugby player, proper rugby player, when, you know, tight heads weren't seen as, they didn't have to make tackles, they didn't have to offload back in those days. You know, now clearly they do. But Victor was ahead of his time. He really was an outstanding player.
Dan Lyle coming from America was an amazing athlete.
What a talent, number eight, the American Eagles captain. I mean, I played with some great number eights over the years, including Bath, Ben Clark and Eric Peters. But Dan Lyle's skill set was just off the scale.
Dan Lyle picks and drives and scores.
He played American football, so his hand-eye coordination, his skill level was brilliant. He wasn't held back by the constraints that rugby can give you if rugby is the only sport you've ever played and you're the sort of orthodox number eight. He was an unorthodox number eight, but some of the things he did was unbelievable.
My goodness, Cardiff turned up today, but into the last four, it is Bath.
Dan Lyle's injury time try secured the game and a 32-21 win for Bath, revenge for the season before. And Bath's chance to make the final came just 5 days before Christmas. They were the only English side remaining, with all other three semi-finalists coming from France. Poe, who had dumped Leicester out in the quarterfinals, would stand in their way at the rec. And Bath's preparations were far from perfect, coming into the game off a 50-23 thrashing by Saracens.
We weren't daunted by the prospect of playing Poe at home. We were just, I suppose, anxious that our stage had come and we didn't want to fluff our lines.
I can remember it was wet. There was great expectation on that day because we knew if we won that game, we were in the European Cup final. Whether we were going to win it or not, it was going to be a massive achievement just to get to the Cup final. And all I had in my mind as well, there was a massive bonus for winning, which always helped.
Without sounding arrogant, I knew we were going to win that game. I absolutely did. Poe were not one of the best French sides. It's remarkable how they got that far, to be perfectly honest. I knew we were going to win. And maybe it's part of that record that Bath at that time had never lost a semi-final.
To the semi, and John Callard had been a little off target, but prop Victor Abogo once again scored a vital try in Europe.
A galloping Lyle, a charging Abogo, and it is Victor Abogo again.
And personally, I can remember early on fluffing a few kicks. It's pretty hard to turn around to your teammates who are working extraordinarily hard to get into position to get you a penalty. And you've got the simple task of putting it over and you're fluffing them.
Oh, John Callard needs to sort this out and sort it out quickly.
And I remember at half-time just turning to the lads in the huddle and say, look, sorry, I'll get it right. Don't worry, I'll get it right.
It's a bit of a glue pot. This isn't easy, but it's a biggie for John Callard. The lead is 17. Every day, down the road at the Landbridge training ground, he slots these with his eyes closed. Oh, yes.
We did a lap of honour. Running around with Bath scarves and hats, and then Bath had never celebrated a semi-final. Never, ever. But we were running around like that we'd won the cup. I look back on that with embarrassment at this stage.
Bath knew this was the biggest day in their history. Now they've got an even bigger one.
2014 was the final score, and in January 1998, Bath would head to Bordeaux and get their chance to make history for English rugby. And it would be their old adversaries Brive once again, defending their title on their home turf, one win each. The game would also decide the destiny of the Heineken Cup.
It was in Bordeaux, which was, 60, 70 miles from Brive. And so we knew we were playing an away game. You know, I think if that had been in the UK, if it had been in North of France, if it had been in Wales, Scotland or Ireland, then I think we were favourites. But as the two games in the group stage proved, there was nothing between them. So I think it was geography. It was the location of the final in Bordeaux that made them favourites.
I remember going to the press conference with Andy Robinson in Bordeaux. I think Laurent Sain was there with his entourage and I was there with Andy Robinson. And the name Pontypridd cropped up and Laurent Sain just gesticulated a spitting motion and it wasn't very pleasant. We don't mention that name. And I remember that's what he said in English. So God knows what he said in French. But he was not best pleased that we'd, or somebody, a brought up Pontypridd.
British and Irish sides have gone down over the years and won in France, but back then it didn't happen very often at all. So we knew we were up against it. It wasn't a great season, quite the opposite. I called a players' meeting. We said, look, we need to sort this out. This is not a coaching issue. This is, you know, have we got our eyes set on the final, which was played on the 31st of January? But once we got into that final week, then it was almost like it was a weight off the shoulders. We could just focus on going to Bordeaux and preparing for what was an international.
John Callard remembers two major issues that affected Bath's preparations. The first would see centre Phil de Glanville a doubt to make the final.
Phil de Glanville would be selected and he had complications, or not him, his wife had complications with the birth of their first child, which, you know, we were desperate for Phil to play. We were going to leave it right up until kickoff whether he could be there to play. So he didn't train with us, wasn't fully integrated, but been around for so long, it didn't matter. There was the case of going to pick him up from the supporters' plane on the night before the game, whether he was going to be on that plane or not. And to the team, you know, a mate of mine, I thought, brilliant, he's on that team.
Then, a training ground bust-up between Andy Robinson and starman Dan Lyle in the days leading up to the final threatened to derail Bath's chances before they'd even kicked off. John Callard stepped in as a bit of a peacemaker.
The training session, the open-air training session we had on the Thursday night when we arrived in Brieve in front of 200, 300 local people. Unfortunately, Robbo let the dogs off and had a little fallout with Dan Lyle. It was quite amusing spat at the time, and both were quite stubborn. And I pleaded with Robbo on the Friday morning, look, we need Dan. Dan's an extraordinary player. You know, he's the main part of that fulcrum off the eight, so to speak. You know, coming off the scrum, the eight is the fulcrum we need. And Robbo's like, please, Robbo, I plead with you. Let's just make it up, play the game, and then you can have your tete-a-tete or whatever you want after that. Let's just make it up for the game. And thankfully they did.
We were massive underdogs. You know, I can remember going into the game and thinking, you know, we knew we were coming up against a French side in a French place, and people were talking us all down. You know, we were in for a really tough day.
I remember going to the game and just being passed by Brieve supporter after Brieve supporter, because we were about 45 minutes drive from the ground, from our hotel, which was very nice, by the way. Car after car would come past with flags, honking the horn, boom, boom, boom. Thought there must be a game on somewhere today. Yeah, obviously it was our game. And then this is where the credit to the Bath fans are. Just turned the corner and there was just this huge procession of supporters. Some had gone to the extra mile to dress up in Roman costumes and were marching down the street. And just the procession coming down the street and marching past the bus. And I think that just lifted everybody on the bus.
The change rooms were like, they were miles away from the ground. And all I was concerned about the day was I knew the battle that we were going to have to go in. I knew the role that I'd been given for that day. And I was expecting to get cut up. And all I was worried about was where I was going to get the stitches done. And I wasn't walking back to the change rooms to walk all the way back. So, you know, me and the doctor had a walk around the ground and we find like a little cubby hole near the ground. So I said, right, I'll get stitched by her. You know, I was expecting that much to be cut up on that day.
And then you get changed, you go for your warm-up through this 200-metre tunnel, which was a warm-up in itself, and then walk back. Then you have your final team talk and go out. And just an amazing, amazing feeling. Bath, blue, black and white. Brieve, black and white. Completely, two sides. Those fans were brilliant. Had never lost faith in us. And the sort of the noise, one catch, one kick, one line out, scrum. Just how they'd lift the side. Credit to them that made the journey. They're just as important as the players were in that final.
In my mind, we had to take it to Brieve. We had to, you know, stand toe-to-toe with them and take them on at what they were good at. So my game plan was pick you a number out before the kick-off, run at him and fight. And I talked to everybody about it, and we were all on board. I will be honest, I cheated a bit because I was playing seven, but playing blindside, and I was up against a guy called, I think it was Van der Linden or Van der Berg, or he had a bit of a Dutch name, and he looked a complete psycho. So I said to Nathan Thomas, he's your man. And I had Olivier Magne. And if you go back to one of the first kickoffs we kicked off, and I had it all in my mind, I'm just going to beat Olivier Magne up. And I went straight for him, and I started on him, and I was expecting everybody else to have their numbers. And I stood up, and I was getting beaten up by the French back. So That didn't work. But we did take it to him physically as a team, not so much as the way I wanted to, but, you know, to a man, the Bath pack stood up to everybody.
As the two games in the group stage proved, there was nothing between them. Absolutely nothing between the sides.
During that game, obviously, we were under pressure all the time. You know, we were defending for our lives most of the time and giving penalties away.
We've got two world-class kickers in this final. La Maison and Callard, this battle off the kicking tee. Christophe La Maison from a mile out. La Maison, you knew he would. Callard, that'll help. Bath up and running.
What a massive moment in that game was Ian Evans on a tap tackle.
Cara was breaking away and Ian managed to tap tackle him. I'd like to tell Ian I thought I had him covered.
Half-time in the final here in Bordeaux and Bath with work to do. Breve ahead, 15-6.
Ian Evans' fingertips kept Bath in the match. Barely. The pressure continued after the break when Breve camped metres from Bath's line and threatened to pull away.
I think they had, I think it was 8 to 10 minutes of scrummaging on our line.
I'm not going to lie to you, I stood there with my fingers crossed.
We concede then, game over. I've stood next to thousands of scrums. No words I say can help what they're having to put themselves through.
Dave Hilton, Mark Regan and Victor stood up to that, you know, scrum after scrum. And then I can remember we came up with a penalty at the end then and we knew that we were still in the game then.
The scrum was definitely the turning point.
If they'd have scored when they were on our line, that would have taken it, you know, 22 points to 6, and we would have been gone then. You know, we knew we had something special in us that we could pull it off.
After withstanding all the pressure, a driving run from Dan Lyle and a quick ball out wide, and suddenly Bath had hope.
Shadows lengthening, but this a really handy position. Lyle controls and goes. The captain, Nicol, to a gliding Guscott. Callard next door. He's over.
Fell over from about 2 or 3 yards.
We knew we were in a game then, but then he pulled off that 45-metre drop goal.
Oh, wow, Alan Penault.
Callard conversion, and then a penalty either side of an Alan Penault drop goal for Breve took Bath to within 2 points. Breve led 18-16, and the clock was in injury time. And then Adebayo Adebayo was obstructed on a run by Ivan Mans, and Bath and Callard had a shot at glory.
Addy went down the left wing and was tackled.
And then instantly you're going, I hope that's a penalty, I hope that's a penalty.
And Dave McHugh, touch judge, gave the penalty. And so it was where the ball landed and in 15. It was, I'd say, soft, but I was delighted.
And then your processes start thinking about, right, I've got a shot.
Hands up if you'd fancy this.
I just remember just putting a little bit of draw on it and it came in from right to left.
Into the setting sun for the lead!
Thought possibly that was the end of the game.
For maybe the cup, John Callard, maybe history.
We were all jumping up and down thinking we'd won the game and, you know, forgetting we still had another, I think it was 90 seconds to play.
Bath led for the first time in the match and the clock was ticking down. All over? Oh no.
We got the kickoff, but we panicked a little bit and we didn't put a good kick down. So we suddenly now were defending. We knew that the line-out drive was coming.
Seconds to go. Last chance saloon stuff. This for Breve. Oh, it's a penalty!
And we get penalised.
Thinking back, I might have given the penalty away again for pulling the line-out down.
They've got a shot to win the game. Well, I thought my kick was the last kick. This is definitely the last kick.
He'll be the Lord Mayor of Breve if this goes over.
And you're thinking there, we've run out of time and we've lost.
La Maison, so accurate all game, with a relatively simple kick to win it for Breve and sealed back-to-back titles.
Oh! He sort of fell off his kick and pushed it right with no power at all on it.
He missed it, and again, it seemed all over. But with the penalty going wide, Andy Nicol fumbled the chance to end the match, and more drama was to come.
All I had to do was catch the ball, touch the ball down, and I think we were winning the Heineken Cup. Inexplicably, it went. I dropped it. It went straight through my hands. And I'll be honest, in that moment, I thought I, personally, had lost the Heineken Cup.
And it's a 5-metre scrum to Breve. Then, that's alarm bells again.
My face, I'm like a ghost.
It's come down to this.
they do get a good scrum. It's all rushed.
Straight in front of it. It's the easiest kick that I guess he'll ever have. What was about to be the greatest moment of my career, I thought it was about to then be the worst.
Lisandro Abrizu with the drop goal for Brive right under the post. This was it. This was the moment.
Oh, he's missed it.
He just put it off to the right.
And it's loose.
Thank the Lord.
And Webster's there. And it's the whistle and it's all over.
And that was, yeah.
Talk about a roller coaster of emotions. I'd gone from the high of that ball coming towards me, thinking I've won the Heineken Cup, to dropping it, thinking I'd lost the Heineken Cup, to then winning it.
Yeah, everything you dream for.
And Bath are the European champions!
Heineken Cup winners, and the example for all Premiership sides that were to follow them, as Northampton, Leicester and Wasps all tasted European glory in 4 of the 6 years that followed. Although that bad side never again captured the same glorious heights of 1998, Richard Webster, John Callard and Andy Nicol had blazed a trail and made history for Bath, kings of Europe.
And to turn it round the way we did was fantastic. To say that we were the first British European champions means a lot.
Richard Webster from Swansea, you know, going to a place like that and playing alongside Jeremy Guscott and John Callard, I wasn't supposed to be there, you know. It was a dream come true for me, you know. Best feelings I've ever had in rugby.
So we're going for a night out in Bordeaux and the bus turns up at a fast food restaurant where the majority of the players queued up for a burger with the local supporters. It was just surreal. Going from winning a cup competition in that manner, on that day, in those circumstances, to queuing up and asking for 2 Big Macs and fries, please. That's only rugby could do that.
Me and my wife often go back to Bath now, and I walk through the ground and I stand there, and it still gives me a little shudder to think that I played on that ground and did play a part in their history. The Bath days and the people I played with in Bath were a special time.
12 years later, I was in Edinburgh with my 2 daughters, walking down the Royal Mile, and there was 2 couples came towards me, and they just stopped, and in a really strong West Country accent, they said, "Andy, thank you, we were there." And then they walked off. My eldest daughter, Tash, said, "Daddy, what did they mean?" I said, "Well, Tash, your daddy played in a game of rugby that meant so much for so many people." And they were just saying thank you.